listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held. KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Norbaras Rudin joins us for a troubling new edition of the Electronic Intifada newscast on the expanding destruction, starvation, and outright genocide in Gaza. Also, anti-genocide activists prepare for more protests at the Israeli consulate in San Francisco, California. More than 120 prominent Jewish Americans sign a statement voicing opposition to the Trump administration's policy of using false accusations of anti-Semitism to facilitate attacks on colleges. And more daily poems from the genocide from noted poet and Rilke translator Anita Barrows. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay right there. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We've got a lot coming up for you in the show today, a lot of important issues to deal with. Of course, we're going to do what we do usually on Thursdays, which is we feature the brand new newscast from the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barrows Friedman. Listen to this.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 706 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel has killed at least 500 Palestinians and injured nearly 2,300 between September 3rd and September 10th, according to official records from the Ministry of Health in Gaza. On Wednesday, September 10th, at least 72 Palestinians were killed since dawn, including 53 in Gaza City alone. Israel has put the entirety of Gaza City under a forced displacement order as it bombs high-rise apartment and office towers, homes, and shelters, vaporizing dozens of buildings, one city block after another, with no end in sight. Our contributor Asim Anabih, the spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, posted this photo of one of the leaflets the Israelis dropped over Gaza City on September 8th. He writes that, quote, "As the sun rises, Israel drops leaflets on us, demanding that we leave Gaza City. I contemplate the leaflet and its poor language. I contemplate the details of the faces of my fellow workers and engineers, still preparing their equipment to begin work. I go out to the gate of the heavy machinery garage and contemplate the heavy footsteps of the people and their emaciated bodies. I return to my office, burdened with sadness and grief for Gaza, its people, and myself. I sit on a chair worn by war, dust, and worries, browsing the news and photos of my beloved thousands of miles away. All that comes to my mind is that death is very close, closer than ever, and God is the source of help. Since Friday, September 5th, at least 7 high-rise towers have been obliterated by constant Israeli airstrikes. The Mushtaha Tower was destroyed on September 5th. Journalist Wissam Shabbat filmed this clip showing the moment Israeli warplanes targeted the high-rise. The Al-Susi high-rise residential building was struck on September 6th. Instagram user Yazan Racha filmed this clip. On September 7th, the Al-Roya commercial building was destroyed. Journalist Ahmed Ibrahim captured the explosion on camera. The 12-floor building housed the headquarters of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with media offices, medical clinics, sports facilities, and other civilian offices and companies. PCHR said that their office on the top floor had been bombarded and extensively damaged since the start of the ongoing genocide. It was also raided by the Israeli army and used as a military base during its previous operations in Gaza City, rendering their offices inoperable. Their two other offices in Khan Yunis and Jabalia were completely destroyed last year, the group added. The Israeli army hit As-Salam Tower at night on September 8th. Journalist Faiz Koreka shot this video of the moment the building exploded. Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, stated on September 8th that the 5 buildings that had been destroyed until that point contained more than 200 apartments, with at least 20 people per unit, leaving more than 4,100 residents homeless in one night. Surrounding the towers, he says, were more than 350 tents, each sheltering families of around 10 people, which were also destroyed, displacing another 3,500. In total, more than 550 families, some 7,600 people, have been stripped of shelter and basic necessities, forced into tragic and unbearable conditions. We continue to call on the world, he says, to take action to protect innocent people here in Gaza before it is too late. More massive apartment blocks were destroyed on September 9th, and on September 10th, Israel hit the Taiba Towers in western Gaza City. Instagram user Mohammed Hamouda filmed this clip. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated that the airstrike killed approximately 15 displaced Palestinians who had sought safety in and around the building. Civil defense worker Mohammed Komsan described the overwhelming terror of displaced families as Israel's wanton destruction of Gaza City has escalated.
Hello everyone. Today in Gaza we're facing all kinds of forced displacement, not just a house or two. The occupation bombs massive residential towers that once sheltered hundreds of families. In seconds, their dreams and memories are gone. And when a tower collapses, one big question remains. Where are all these families supposed to go? Where is their in a safe place left? Every day the space around us gets smaller. The occupation advances, pushing us tighter between the sea, the tanks, and the rubble. Displacement isn't just losing walls of your home. It's a deep psychological wound. It can stand fear, an anxiety, a scene of loss, and sometimes even feel like a stranger among your own people. This is our reality today, a reality where people are stripped of the simplest right, the right to have a place to sleep.
Mohammed Komsan of the Civil Defense in Gaza. The strike on the Al-Roya commercial building on September 7th happened just days after the United States officially sanctioned the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, along with Al-Haq and Al-Mizan, the leading human rights organizations working on international criminal accountability for perpetrators of atrocity crimes in Palestine. In a joint statement on September 5th, the human rights groups said that, quote, threatened by the impact and role of our advocacy, legal research, and documentation in exposing Israel's ongoing international crimes, the United States has resorted to punishing individuals and organizations seeking to uphold the legal system upon which the international community was founded. The implications go beyond Palestine. By protecting Israel from accountability, they are dismantling the international legal order and undermining the possibility of justice for victims of grave crimes anywhere. Israel also targeted a facility for people with disabilities in central Gaza City on September 7th. Journalist Ahmed Kahil captured the strike. Kahil also documented Israel's attack on the Thauba Mosque that same day in the Al-Daraj neighborhood. He says that right after the attack on the mosque, the area was targeted a second time while he was filming. Quote, just now the place was bombed again, a totally random bombing, he says. A man on the street tells Kahil that the Israeli army called people and said they will strike again and told them to evacuate this area as they are about to bomb it. That was from journalist Ahmed Kahil on September 7th. Palestinians in Gaza City say they are not leaving their city on Israel's orders. Journalist Nahed Hajjaj captured this clip of a man standing on a pile of rubble on September 10th, saying, quote, the army is striking high-rise buildings to force people to go south. I'm not leaving. If Netanyahu destroys everything, I'm not leaving. I will clean this up and live here once again. I'm not leaving. Even if I have to die here, I am not leaving. Palestinians led a demonstration in Gaza City against Israel's genocidal displacement orders. Dr. Munir Al-Bersh, the Director General of the Ministry of Health in Gaza, stated, quote, in a historic scene, community leaders, families, healthcare teams, and all the people of Gaza gathered in one of the largest demonstrations, carrying Palestinian flags and symbolic shrouds to declare a unified stance. Displacement from Gaza only towards the sky. Gaza tells the world, we will not leave except as martyrs. Here we were born and here we remain. Meanwhile, a BBC investigation found that U.S. mercenary forces working security at the joint American-Israeli private Gaza Humanitarian Foundation killing sites masquerading as aid distribution points include members of a motorcycle gang with an extremist right-wing white Christian nationalist ideology. At least 10 members of the Infidels Motorcycle Club who are working in Gaza for UG Solutions, a private contractor providing security at the GHF sites, have been identified by the British broadcaster, which revealed that 7 members of the gang are in senior security positions in Gaza. Quote, Infidels MC was set up by U.S. military veterans of the Iraq War in 2006, and members see themselves as modern crusaders, using the crusader cross as their symbol, a reference to the medieval Christians who fought Muslims for control of Jerusalem, the BBC says. The gang is currently hosting anti-Muslim hate speech on its Facebook page and has previously held a pig roast in defiance of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The gang's leader, Johnny Taz Mulford, is a former sergeant in the U.S. Army who was punished for conspiracy to commit bribery, theft, and making false statements to military authorities. He is now the country team leader running UG Solutions' contract in Gaza. UG Solutions is paying each contractor nearly $1,000 per day, including expenses, rising to about $1,600 per day for team leaders at GHF's so-called safe distribution sites, documents seen by the BBC show. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have killed nearly 2,500 Palestinians and injured more than 17,000 at so-called aid sites since the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation began its operations in late May, according to the Ministry of Health in Gaza. Children and adults alike are continuing to die of starvation across Gaza. The health ministry said that 5 deaths from starvation were reported between Tuesday and Wednesday, including a child, bringing the total recorded number of deaths from malnutrition to 404, including 141 children. The mother of 18-month-old Ali Abdel Nasser Abu Adra, who is hospitalized with extreme malnutrition at Nasser Medical Complex, says that her baby's weight has dropped to just 3 kilograms. He should weigh at least 10, and he is suffering from chronic diarrhea and dehydration. Journalist Mohammed Ashraf Salama captured this clip of the mother and her baby Ali earlier this week. She says that her son is so fragile that medical staff haven't been able to insert an intravenous cannula into his body for the past 10 days, and that he is in desperate need of treatments that are not available due to Israel's ongoing blockade. She adds that a referral for medical evacuation was issued 9 months ago and was renewed last month. But the World Health Organization has not contacted her yet, nor have they provided her with any assistance. Malnourished patients at Nasser Medical Complex are dying, she warns. Quote, there is no treatment and no nutrition. Israel is continuing to attack and bomb medical facilities in Gaza. On September 7th, Israeli quadcopter drones attacked the Association for Women and Child Protection, a maternity care facility, killing a child and a pregnant woman seeking services and injuring several Palestinians. A man was also killed. His own child found him in pieces. The man, identified as Ahmed Ashour Al-Ghul, was a staff member at the facility. He had asked his young son, Laith, to fetch his phone charger from his office nearby. As the boy walked back with the charger in hand, the Israeli drone bombed the entrance to the clinic, with Laith finding his father's body and head torn to pieces in front of him, according to Al-Ghul's cousin, the novelist and activist Yusri Al-Ghul. Journalist Mahmoud Abu Salama reported from the scene following the drone strike, along with showing several people killed and wounded. His camera captures Laith staring at his father's body. Abu Salama says that another Israeli airstrike has just happened near the hospital. Quote, here is a violent Israeli airstrike targeting this place. A number of martyrs, as you can see. This is the scene, he says.
استهداف في جوار مستشفى الوفا هنا غارة إسرائيلية عنيفة استهدفت هذا المكان عددا من الشهداء كما تشاهدون هذا هو المشهد لمنتظرين شهداء هذا هو المشهد.
Turning quickly to the occupied West Bank, Israeli settlers stormed Masafer Yatta near Al-Khalil on September 5th, stabbing and assaulting the villagers of Khalat al-Daba. Sahat News Agency reported that at least 13 Palestinians were wounded, including a 3-month-old baby, 2 elders, and women and children. On September 10th, armed settlers attacked the homes and properties of Palestinians south of Al-Khalil, according to Wafa News Agency. A local resident said that settlers used tractors and drones to terrorize people and their livestock in the area. He added that settlers have been playing loud music at night in an attempt to instill fear among the local children. Israeli soldiers have been raiding towns and villages northwest of Jerusalem for days, following a suspected resistance operation by Palestinians earlier this week at the Ramot Junction in occupied East Jerusalem, which killed 6 people and wounded 12. Local sources told Wafa News Agency on Wednesday that Israeli forces stormed the town of Biddu amidst confrontations and fired live ammunition, tear gas, and sound bombs at Palestinians. They raided and searched several homes. The sources added that Israel launched a large-scale raid on homes in the towns of Katna and Al-Kubayba, assaulting people, ransacking and searching their contents, and turning a home into a military barracks. They detained and interrogated citizens on the spot. Al Jazeera reported on September 9th that during the intensified raids, Israeli forces destroyed 3 other homes of Palestinian resistance operatives and a detainee accused of an earlier attack as punishment. Soldiers encircled the house of detainee Thabet Masalma, accused of having carried out a shooting in December in the town of Beit Awa, southwest of Hebron, before blowing up the property with explosives. The raid sparked clashes with locals, during which Israeli soldiers fired live ammunition, wounding 2 people. Masalma is accused of taking part in an attack that killed an Israeli settler and wounded 3 people. The demolition left the detainee's wife, parents, and 3 children homeless in the town of Aqaba, north of Tubas. Israeli forces also demolished the homes of 2 prominent local leaders of the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, who had been killed in Israeli operations, Al Jazeera reported. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight There Is Nowhere Left to Go, We Are Trapped, by Malak Hijazi, writing from Gaza City. Malak writes, quote, "Before the announcement of a ceasefire in January 2025, I was among the 400,000 people who stayed in northern Gaza. The experience was overwhelming and unbearably hard. Israel did everything possible to force us southward. We endured severe bombardment, chessboard-like displacement, and famine for more than a year. But my family and I refused to leave. We knew the occupation could not force us to abandon the places where we were born, raised, and lived most of our lives. And we knew that if we left northern Gaza, the occupation would take over our land. The morning of September 9th, after a night of relentless shelling that shook both the walls and our nerves, I woke to the news that the Israeli army had ordered 900,000 people in Gaza City to move southward to what they call a humanitarian zone. The warning came shortly after Netanyahu declared, quote, in the past 2 days, 50 of these towers have fallen. The Air Force brought them down. Now all of this is just an introduction, just a prelude to the main intense operation, a ground maneuver of our forces who are now organizing and gathering in Gaza City. On the maps, the entire area was marked in red, a color that now signifies danger and death. Netanyahu calls these attacks a prelude, while for us, life has been a continuous hell. The Israeli F-16s and helicopters are intensifying their bombing of the city while quadcopter drones hover above. Sometimes they drop leaflets with evacuation orders. Other times they release small bombs directly over our heads and homes. They have broadcast insults that I have personally heard, calling us cows and dogs, or shout, stay tuned, we will invade Gaza City soon. In recent days, Israel has destroyed several prominent buildings in Gaza, including Al-Susi and Al-Roya Towers, landmarks that once anchored neighborhoods and gave the city a sense of structure, identity, and even a hint of modernity. The families who had lived in them were suddenly homeless. These buildings had also been surrounded by dozens of tents, families living in their shadow after losing their homes. When the towers fell, the rubble crushed the spaces where the tents had been, and the displaced were displaced again, their shelters rendered uninhabitable. This is not a battle. Each armored vehicle carries enough explosive to obliterate everything within 100 meters, including homes, streets, and all that lies between. The tanks roam the streets like mechanized predators, forcing entire neighborhoods to flee in panic. My family and I have searched desperately for an apartment farther south in the Strip, Khan Yunis and Rafah have already been pulverized, reduced to ruins. We cannot survive winter in a tent. We have called every number, begged friends, searched endlessly. There is nowhere left in Gaza to absorb us. Many people will not leave, not because they want to risk their lives, but because of the numb indifference that follows witnessing genocide. Death has become, for many, the easier and more affordable option. For us, there is no longer even the illusion of choice. The walls are closing in, and we ask not only where we can go, but whether there will be any place left at all. Those are excerpts from There Is Nowhere Left to Go, We Are Trapped by Malek Hijazi, a writer in Gaza, on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza. Ahmed Muin Abu Amsha, a music teacher and someone we frequently feature in this section, documented his own perilous forced displacement this past week. But in setting up his tent shelter near the beach, he found a new parachute to protect the kids from the sun, which he said he will put above the tents and the activity spaces he and his colleagues have established for music classes. He captioned this clip, quote, "We played with it under the strong wind. It was pulling us, and the children's laughter filled the air. Later, we set it up as a safe shade above the tents. Even though preparing the new space took so much time and effort, we do our best to create a place of joy and hope for the children."
Hello, everyone. Today, we have a parachute. I'm going to put it above my tents and for the activity to cover the kids from the sun.
And Instagram user Mohamed Abu Kamar, who regularly posts videos singing with friends and children on the beach, sang a song for the Gaza-bound International Flotilla, which is aiming to break the siege on Gaza with dozens of boats this week. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
From the Electronic Intifada newscast, Nora Barrows-Friedman. We've been working with her for a long time, and I am grateful for that reporting and that we have these beautiful microphones, these free speech, truth to power, no holes barred microphones still to broadcast to you that kind of in-depth reporting. We continue our coverage of the, we have to say, expanding genocide in Palestine. This one brings us back to the United States. 120 prominent Jewish Americans signed a statement released today voicing opposition to the Trump administration's policy of disingenuously using accusations of anti-Semitism to sue to facilitate attacks on colleges and the detention and deportation of campus activists. Joining us to talk about this letter is a good friend from Roots Action, Sam Rosenthal. He is the political director. Sam, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. Could you take a moment and explain what exactly the statement is and what inspired it?
Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me back. I'm happy to be here again. So this is a statement that Roots Action, along with Progressive Democrats of America and Jewish Voice for Peace, put together that we thought it was important to get together a group of Jewish Americans, especially those working in prominent positions in academia, in the arts, also, sort of commentators, writers, et cetera, to take head on the way that Donald Trump has approached combating anti-Semitism on college campuses. So this effort started, of course, last spring, and we worked through the summer to get these signatures together. And now, as we start the next academic school year, we thought it was an opportune time to release this letter. And the letter is basically calling for an end to using the cloak of anti-Semitism as a smokescreen to persecute college campuses, persecute students in particular on college campuses for exercising their First Amendment rights, particularly when it comes to protesting the genocide in Gaza.
It's become quite a effective sledgehammer, if you will, against the emerging worldwide movement in support of Palestinian rights and against what everybody knows is now a genocide. They shut the colleges down. Now, you remember all those protests? What happened to all of them?
Yeah, that's right. And many college administrations we've seen initially adopted sort of a more defiant attitude towards Trump and towards the Trump administration, but were within themselves deeply, deeply conflicted about trying to reconcile their, duty to stand by students who are exercising their First Amendment rights while trying to appease influential alumni, influential commentators around the universities. And since these, pro-Palestine protests kicked off in earnest, we've really seen most universities, not all, but most, do at least, a significant turn, if not a complete 180 from their initial position, and now are quite accommodationist when it comes to the Trump administration and when it comes to buying this rhetoric in general that this is these attempts to quell free speech on campuses are really about combating anti-Semitism. And so this letter is trying to put the lie to that claim.
And clearly, the Trump administration has pulled out all the stops in supporting Israel, in enabling, fully funding this extraordinary genocide that the whole world is watching and the United States is funding.
Yeah, exactly. They've been working hand in glove with this administration, this incredibly right-wing administration that we've seen in Israel. And we think that anyone who believes that these claims made by the administration, the Trump administration, that they're earnest about combating anti-Semitism really bears scrutiny. This is an administration that is far right. Donald Trump has openly associated with known anti-Semites, not people who are winking at anti-Semitism or hinting at it, but people like Nick Fuentes, for example, who are out anti-Semites. So this is an administration who has really welcomed people who are really true anti-Semites into the ranks of the administration. And at the same time, they turn around and act like they're trying to be champions for the rights of Jewish Americans, when in truth, many of the students who have been the target of persecution, the target of doxing on college campuses are Jewish students. So this is a complete fabrication. It's a total falsehood. And we think that it's time for universities to call this out for what it is.
And clearly still, in the face of all this, there's extraordinary censorship, self-censorship in terms of what is really going on the ground, in terms of the extraordinary suffering of a people. I mean, we're watching 12 and 14 story buildings being dropped, people getting 15 minutes to get out, and dropping, you know, destroying cities. So there clearly is this thing that everybody is watching happen. And this kind of activity, this kind of intimidation coming out of the U.S. government is coming at a very crucial time and playing a key role in this genocide, besides arming the genocide, right? This is a huge problem.
Absolutely. And there's really a concerted disinformation campaign happening at the highest levels of American society right now, where these institutions that are supposed to be places of learning and inquiry are demanding that students not think critically about what they see in front of them on their phones every day. These are, you know, people between the ages of maybe 18 and 22 years who spend hours and hours every day looking at their phones and seeing images of wartime atrocity happening. Every single day, a new image of wartime atrocity. And that's combined with what's happening at the geopolitical level, where you see Israel just this week attacking a nominal ally of the U.S. I mean, really operating as a rogue state in the region at this point. And we are asking young people to not believe what they see in front of them and to instead sort of spurn the truth that's on their screens in favor of some idea about combating anti-Semitism that they know to be disingenuous and we know to be disingenuous.
Before we let you go, you say there's this statement, 120 prominent Jewish Americans signed onto it. Who are those folks? What did some of them say? Why was it important? Why did you get the support that you got?
Sure. So this statement builds on a statement that the same organizations, Roots Action and Progressive Democrats of America and Jewish Voice for Peace, worked on last year that was decrying the influence of the Israel right or wrong lobby in U.S. elections, and particularly AIPAC and DMFI, who are making huge spends in elections, especially to unseat progressives in Congress. And we thought that this was part of the same trend, that there's a lobby that's active in undermining American democracy and undermining our freedom of speech in this country, all towards one end, which is stifling criticism of Israel and stifling criticism of the ongoing genocide. So we wanted to get academics on the record. We wanted to get prominent cultural commentators, people in the arts on the record, in saying we are still paying attention to the way that this reality is being shaped, to the narrative that the mainstream media is trying to browbeat into us, and we reject it. We reject the idea that there can't be freedom of speech around this issue. We reject the idea that we can't elect the people we want into office. So we have people, if you look at our letter, you'll see names from sort of across the spectrum. We have people who have spent years in the university, years in the academy, those who are, you know, started businesses, who are journalists, who are musicians, but they're all united in their opposition to what we see as this growing influence of this far-right lobby in the United States.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. We appreciate the time, Sam. And I think it's really important for people to watch what's going on, because, it gets more and more brutal by the day, and the inability to get the corporate controllers of the information flow to really cover it in any substantive way is quite a struggle. Right, I mean, you had to get away with dropping these 12 and 14 story buildings with U.S. bombs for no good reason. I mean, turning dust into dust. this is a real problem, and it's an information problem. And the networks don't say the words that they need to say. So thanks for taking the time. We appreciate it, and we will stay in touch with Roots Action. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Short break. When we come back, we're going to find out what some activists are up to in San Francisco. Stay tuned. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's a network founded, in 1949 by some folks who understood how important it was to try and preserve or keep a free, open flow of information for the people. So this marvelous radio station network was founded, listener-sponsored. We continue the work. Joining us, and somebody who has definitely been exercising her free speech when it comes to the expanding genocide in Gaza, is Cynthia Papermaster, Bay Area Code Pink. Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints. You've been spending Fridays in San Francisco. What have you been up to?
Hi, Dennis. Hello, everybody. I went to Detroit for the People's Palestine Conference, which was incredible. It was 3 days of nonstop just learning about what's going on and organizing. And there were over 4,000 people in attendance. It's just amazing. Of course, Code Pink was there. And we had our flotilla boat with, we just pretended we were on a flotilla, and we, you know, we're following the flotilla that's trying to reach Gaza. That was a tremendous experience, and I followed that by a visit to Manhattan, where we had a press conference with Taxpayers Against Genocide, filing our amended complaint with the Inter-American Human Rights Commission against our government for genocide. So it's been an incredible week.
Amazing.
For me. Just, yeah. And then tomorrow, we're in action again. We're going to the Israeli consulate at 456 Montgomery Street in the Financial District. I've just prepared 3 jars of blood, not real blood. We're going to show our blood red hands. We're going to show our grief. We're going to show how we cannot look away. We have to call it out. We have to continue calling it out. And we're joined there by another group, or autonomous groups, doing a noise action at the Israeli Zionist consulate to demand that Israel and the U.S. stop murdering and starving civilians in Gaza. So I hope people will come out. It's from 10:30 a.m. until noon at the Israeli consulate, 456 Montgomery Street in the Financial District.
And why are you going there?
Well, I'm going to read you a real quick, just a couple sentences from the post that's on indiebay.org. Israel, stop killing Palestinians, stop starving Gaza. A loud noise action at the Israel consulate to protest that rogue nation's horrible war crime. Their sadistic starvation of Palestinians, their genocidal killing of women and children, the repulsive lying of Netanyahu and his psychopathic allies, and the wicked, vile, cravenly murder of humanitarian aid workers, hospital workers, academics, babies, and children, plus the destruction of Palestinian homes, hospital businesses, mosques, churches, museums, university. Let the flotilla in, stop the madness, and we will create a furious ruckus.
That's Cynthia Papermaster. And you do this every week? Why do you feel it's important? Why do you feel it's important for you to be there at this point? What does that mean to you?
Thank you. This happens every week. I think people need to check IndieBay.org to make sure it's happening. That's the calendar of actions in the Bay Area. We have an Israeli consulate right here in the Bay Area. The entity that's responsible for this horrible genocide going on. And so that gives us an opportunity to raise our voices. And we do it in grief. We do it in anguish. I don't know anyone who's having a normal life right now. I don't know about you. I know you're not. You know, you tell me all the time. We are suffering terribly because the actions of our country supporting this genocide, supplying weapons, supplying money, political support, everything. And we grieve, but we also get into action. And I just encourage everyone to come out tomorrow, meet up with us in front of the Israeli consulate, express yourself, bang, make some noise. Thank you.
And you believe fully and thoroughly in nonviolence?
I do. Yeah, I'm totally a nonviolent person. I don't like any war. I don't like any suffering. We don't have to have that. We should be cooperating with each other. Don't get me started.
Okay, I won't. I promise I won't. That's Cynthia Papermaster. She works with Code Pink, and she does lots of wonderful, beautiful things for the people. Thank you, Cynthia, for taking the time out and being with us, and for going to New York and all over the place and reporting for us. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. And you're listening to Flashpoints. We take a short break, and we're going to invite back Anita Barrows, who, as you know, has been writing a poem for every day of the genocide, and a serious, extraordinary series of poems that will be remembered for a long time, as we will remember as long as we can the suffering that is going on and it's being carried out, financed from here in the United States of America. Stay with us. We'll be back. Airwaves, poet, translator, psychotherapist for very troubled children, poetry teacher for different kinds of folks, some of them now living through the genocide in Gaza, Anita Barrows. Welcome back to Flashpoints. This is a very troubling time. You know, you watch those 12 and 14 story buildings being collapsed on purpose on top of people with children crying. And you can only wonder what damage this is doing to the consciousness of those kids. Anita, you welcome back. I know you've been writing a poem every single day of this genocide, and thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Yes, I have been writing. We're now up to day 706, which just seems unimaginable. And nothing seems to be stopping Israel from doing what it's doing. It's unbelievable. I can start with the one I wrote today because it's about, you know, exactly what you were talking about, these huge buildings in Gaza City that are being...
For torture.
Collapsed.
It's like a torture. It's like a torture.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, this is what we're going to do to you. I'm sorry.
Yes, exactly. So this is today's poem, day 706. A boy is picking through the rubble, looking for anything there might be to eat, looking for shoes that might fit his sister, looking for a ball to throw, a piece of a blanket to cover his mother, a cap to shield himself from the sun. He is picking through the rubble of somebody's world. He doesn't know who they were, the people who lived in this building. Did they have children his age? Were they asleep when the bombs exploded? Were they awake, sitting and talking? Were the parents teachers, nurses, plumbers? Were they sitting at their table? Were they sleeping in their beds? What were their voices like? What did they feel when they saw the walls caving in, all the objects of their lives falling on top of them? Ah, those images of the buildings are just heartbreaking. I want to read day 702, a few days ago. They are killed while waiting in line for water. They are killed while waiting for bread at a bakery. They are killed while making tea for their children, while they walk between tents, while they're reading, writing, sleeping. They're killed while carrying their children. They're killed while carrying their grandparents. They're killed while carrying pots, bowls, baskets, buckets. They are killed while walking with canes, sticks, while holding each other's arms. They are killed while sitting down in the hot sun on the hard ground because they are weak from not eating. They are weak from not sleeping because of the explosions. They are weak from grieving. One by one, they are dying. Many by many, they are saying goodbye to their infants. They are saying goodbye to their fields, their neighborhoods, their animals, their friends. They are saying goodbye to the radiant suns their children have drawn with chalk on the broken walls, reminding us that there is still light, bleak though it is. That last image of the radiant suns, the graffiti that some kids are drawing on the walls of the rubble, the collapsed walls of Gaza City, that's an image that was told to me by my wonderful student in Gaza City, whom I write to every day just to make sure that she's still living. And she's not only still living, she's still writing. And I have a poem by Takwa that I would like to read. Takwa is 19. Her full name is Takwa Ahmed Alwawi. And she just began writing poems a few months ago. And I've been mentoring her as a poet. This is Slow Death, is the title of her poem. I sit back against the wall. A mug warms my hand. The air tightens. A low hum sounds. Far. Fast. The window shakes. A shadow at the door. I freeze. Eyes shut. Time holds its breath. Family. Friends. Places breathing with me. Laughter folded in notebooks. Voices gone. Life flickers behind closed eyes. Seconds stretch. The sound hits, fists pounding. Then it leaves. Silence returns, changed. Eyes open. The mug still warm. The room is silent, but something inside has not survived. My 19-year-old student.
What was that line? Time holds its breath. Yeah.
Time holds its breath. Time
it's
holds
breathtaking.
Its breath.
It's really extraordinary poetry. In a way, it feels, Anita, you're hearing your student's poetry, it feels that it's the most urgency of life, that a lot has to happen, you know, in a little amount of space. And that's sort of what poetry is, you know. You can fit the most meaning make use of every
bit. It's very compressed.
You know?
That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah, very compressed. It's like, you know, little bursts, little bursts of energy.
It's an unbelievable poem.
Yeah, yeah. She's extraordinary. She sent me a file on Sunday of 20 poems, and she said, I want to enter these into a contest. Would you have time to edit them for me by tomorrow night? And so I spent my whole day Sunday on her poems, and I was so, so happy to do it.
It's a kid
who's in Gaza City.
Yeah. Well, why don't you, we've got time for at least another poem.
Great. Wonderful. Okay, this is day 705. Did you think your house would become your tomb? The curtains, your shroud? Shattered doors, your cover? The stairs, a way to another world? Pipes spilling water to wash your body? Did you think all those years when you were a child in that house, smells of cooking wafting through rooms where your uncle sat laughing, your sisters reading, your small brothers teasing each other, cats sleeping? Did you think that in a minute, in less than a minute, it would all be destroyed, flattened, erased? And you, who were born there, buried there, still holding the brush you were brushing your hair with. People
one
frozen
more.
In time.
Yeah.
Okay. I will read. I certainly do. I'm trying to decide which one, but I shouldn't spend.
You got over 700 of them. That's Anita Burroughs, over 700 poems every day of this genocide. I hope you don't reach 1,000 pages.
That's what I hope too. I hope at some point I can stop writing these poems and write poems about the liberation. This is day 704. Where will we go when there's nowhere to go? A mother stands outside her tent holding the hands of two of her children. The others are still sleeping. Yesterday, their friends in another tent were burned alive. Yesterday, the bombs fell continuously, collapsing so many buildings. We were just trying to live our lives, the mother is saying. She tightens her grip on her children's hands. Overhead, the relentless buzzing of drones. The breath of her children is almost synchronized to it as though destruction and death have become their other parents.
Thank you, Anita Barrows, who is a practicing poet and a psychotherapist working with extraordinary children. She's got students now, poetry students in Gaza, and we appreciate them, their poems, and we appreciate you, Anita, and what a wonderful honor to have you as a contributor and a friend here at Free Speech Radio. Be safe. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you.